Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with recent criticism of Trump's domestic and foreign policy coming from Senator McCain, former President George W. Bush, and former Vice President Joe Biden, and speak with a foreign policy advisor to Joe Biden, Dr. Michael Carpenter, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense and Director for Russia on the National Security Council. He joins us to discuss the price the U.S. is paying for the absence of leadership in U.S. foreign policy because of a disengaged and disruptive president who has little knowledge of or interest in global affairs and has not staffed his government with foreign policy and national security professionals. With Iraq about to explode as our allies, the Kurds, are being squeezed by Iran, whose influence in Iraq and Syria grows with the emergence of the Shia Crescent land corridor from Tehran to Damascus, we will assess how much the generals around Trump, who are preoccupied containing him, are not able to pay sufficient attention to the roiling global events that demand daily attention, if not a strategy to deal with them. Then we'll look into the latest expensive headline grabbing by fringe groups on the far right wing like Breitbart, David Horowitz, and Richard Spencer's National Policy Institute, who deliberately choose to speak on liberal campuses like Berkeley, where they are not welcome, to provoke students from minority communities with racist insults in the hope that they can extort media attention and become martyrs for free speech. Clay Calvert, the Brechner Eminent Scholar in Mass Communication and Director of the First Amendment Project at the University of Florida, Gainesville, joins us to discuss the $600,000 expense incurred by his public university today because Richard Spencer decided to speak there, even though a handful of students wanted to hear him, while thousands showed up to protest Spencer, shouting, "Go home, Nazis." Then finally, we will speak with another professor at the University of Florida, Gainesville, Michael Gorham, about a different subject, the latest Kremlin-approved straw man to run against Vladimir Putin in Russia's next presidential election. A professor of Russian studies whose latest project is Russia's Digital Revolution, Language, New Media, and the Unmaking of Civil Society, joins us to discuss how this time the daughter of Putin's political mentor, who is Russia's equivalent of Kim Kardashian or Paris Hilton, will be running to split the opposition vote. And joining us now, Dr. Michael Carpenter, who is a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense with responsibility for Russia, Ukraine, Eurasia, the Balkans, and conventional arms control. He previously served in the White House as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and as Director for Russia at the National Security Council. Prior to that, he was a career Foreign Service officer with the State Department, and he's now Director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Michael Carpenter.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Michael. And your former boss has actually spoken out, even though President Trump has insulted President Obama on a number of occasions. He's accused him of wiretapping him at Trump Tower. He said he was a bad, sick guy. The president has held his powder, even though he was even accused recently of not honoring the fallen, which, of course, was a monstrous and disgusting lie. But I noticed that Vice President Biden actually spoke out the other day rather forcefully. What did you think of that?
Well, I think Vice President Biden has seen that some of the actions and irresponsible rhetoric from Mr. Trump has just simply gone too far, and he feels like he can no longer sit on the sidelines and he has to speak out. And so I think he wanted very much to give a little bit of time and space to the new administration before offering any criticisms or even commentary on what they were doing policy-wise. But it's just gotten to a point where I think he's felt the need to speak out, and so you've seen him do it.
So in terms of, we know we're being distracted all the time, and arguably that is a tactic on the part of President Trump. You could describe it as government by stunt, where we're always being whipsawed from one disaster to another. And in the case, for example, of this current scandal over the soldiers that were killed in Niger, the last thing we're talking about is what's our mission in Niger, what happened to them, etc. We're talking about other things, and that's the way that President Trump appears to have steered it. Do you see that as a method to his madness, or do you think he's just somewhat out of control?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I think on certain occasions, certainly he's tried to change the media narrative by issuing a tweet on something that he knows is going to gain a lot of attention and sway the media from one topic to another. But I think sometimes he's just so undisciplined that he creates crises for himself that are of his own making and that were unintentional. So I think you've seen both over the course of the last 9 months or whatever it is.
So how is this? I mean, I'm assuming, and I'm pretty sure this is the case, that this is taking a toll on U.S. foreign policy, that we know that there's a huge vacuum, particularly in the State Department, in terms of personnel and slots that are still open. And we know from what the chairman, the Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has said, Senator Corker, that the White House is something like an adult daycare center, and the assumption being that the generals spend an awful lot of their time containing, I think is the word that Corker used, containing President Trump. This means that they're not spending their time doing what you and Vice President Biden and Obama and everybody else in the National Security Council was doing in the previous administration, which is taking care of this unpredictable roiling world out there.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think there are too many distractions. There are too many vacant chairs in our national security apparatus. And the president is so undisciplined and creates so many crises, as I said, of his own making that we've got one hand, probably two hands, actually tied behind our back in terms of our ability to cope with global challenges right now. And there's a lot of them. There's North Korea, there's Iran, there's Russia. There's so many things going on, and yet we are incredibly hamstrung by this administration's both ineptitude, unwillingness to fill key, very important positions in the State Department, the Defense Department, elsewhere, and then by this sort of reckless rhetoric that is coming from the White House. And so we have lost a lot of standing with our allies, not just with our allies, but with countries around the world. I mean, I travel all the time, and a lot of foreign interlocutors want to know what the heck is going on in Washington and seek to understand, you know, who is actually directing the ship of state. Who should they talk to when they come to Washington? And it's very hard to advise them because you don't really know. But I think you're also right in that, you know, Secretaries Mattis and Tillerson and National Security Advisor McMaster are interlocutors that are available, but they spend so much time trying to contain or trying to pass policies that rise below the threshold where they need to be notified to the president, that just simply consumes a great part of their day. And by the way, that is what they do. They try to pass policies at their level that don't rise to the president's level, so they don't have to face the risk that something is going to get hijacked or blown up.
My understanding is that some of the more recent moves, which have certainly upset the allies, decertifying the Iran deal, for one, and the sort of final sort of knife in the back of Obamacare, both of those were something along the lines of a compromise where the adults basically fought as much as they could to preserve what they could, particularly with the Iran deal, but had to basically, because he is the president and was apparently insistent, almost, you know, having tantrums on getting his way, that you end up with these compromises, which is an extraordinary situation itself. My sense is that that ought to be a lesson to all of us, particularly people who don't vote, to recognize that presidents have enormous power. I mean, it sounds like somewhat trite, but I don't think people recognize the extent to which, just because of his own demands and personality, U.S. foreign policy has to bend to his whims.
No, I mean, that's absolutely right. And the president has enormous authority, and so the incumbent of that office is able to do a lot of things that are potentially harmful for our national security interests. And that's why it's such an important position. But that's also why you see Congress stepping in at least a little bit, or at least you did on the Russia issue with passing the Countering America's Adversaries Act, which basically provides the executive branch with additional authorities to be able to sanction Russia for its malign behavior. You saw that pass with majorities of 419-3 in the House and 98-2 in the Senate, and it essentially blocks Trump from being able to unilaterally lift sanctions on Russia, which is what he tried to do when he first came into office in January. So you see Congress trying to exert a little bit more of a role to check the executive, but of course the executive has so much power on, particularly on foreign policy and national security issues, that is difficult to do that.
So let's turn to some of the more important foreign policy theaters that seem to be roiling at the moment. I think most of all, what just happened in Iraqi Kurdistan seems to have the greatest potential for a major explosion. First of all, the Syrian Kurds who've just taken Raqqa and the Iraqi Kurds are America's boots on the ground. They've proven themselves to be the only reliable partner in rolling back the Islamic State in both Iraq and Syria. But the Barzani government in the Iraqi Kurdistan went ahead with a referendum, which was extremely ill-advised. My sense is that there wasn't enough engagement from President Trump and his people to dissuade them from doing what they did. And now you have a situation where the Iraqi Quds Force and the General Suleiman, who is as far as America's concerned, is a war criminal. He's responsible for killing a number of Americans during the Iraq War. He's running the show there on the ground. And this is a very explosive situation. The Kurds have been sold out before by Iran. They've got enemies all around them, Turkey, Iran, and now Baghdad. Kirkuk was their cash cow, their form of economic, their economic lifeline, if you will. And everybody's armed to the teeth there. So if you were still in the Pentagon, my sense is that you and your colleagues, your hair would be on fire.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is a failure of diplomacy, and it required the United States to be in constant contact with Barzani and with the Iraqi Kurdistan region leadership to avert what just happened, which is, as you said, an ill-advised referendum, which was then followed by the reaction from the other side, which was the Iraqi government in alliance with Iranian Shia militia taking Kirkuk from the Kurds, which is the lifeline for their economic sustainability as an independent entity within Iraq, taking it away from them and thereby cementing Iran's greater role in the region, which has already been growing over the course of the last several months in Syria, particularly in southern Syria, as Iranian militias seek to create a land bridge through southern Syria into Lebanon. And, you know, this administration claims to be they issue a lot of anti-Iranian rhetoric, which is fine. I mean, Iran is in many ways our adversary across the entire region, across the world. But they haven't taken the diplomatic actions that are necessary to check Iran. And so, paradoxically, even though their rhetoric has been scaled up and they've fought against the Iranian nuclear deal, they've allowed Iran to accumulate vastly more power on the ground in the Middle East than it had 3 or 4 or 6 or 9 months ago. And so, yes, this is a huge challenge. And you've got Russia in the mix, obviously. Now you see that, for example, the Syrian Kurdish leaders are traveling to Moscow to try and do deals with the Kremlin because they see Russia as the major power in the region, and they're not being courted, they're not being talked to by the United States, at least not as much as they were in the past. And so that's a direct, tangible consequence of our scaled-back diplomatic initiative in the Middle East.
And the Russian military forces, along with the Iranians, Hezbollah and Assad's forces, are, what, a couple of miles outside of Raqqa, which the Kurds just took. So that itself is a very tenuous situation. But let's just focus for a little longer on the Iraq situation. My understanding is that our policies there are predicated upon the idea that we want the current incumbent Abadi to win the next elections, and we don't want Maliki to come back, because he's even worse. But what guarantees do we have that the Iranians will let us have an engagement there? Because, as you pointed out, they're getting more and more influence there. They've got their militias on the ground. If the U.S. tears up the deal with Iran, the P5+1 deal, the Supreme Leader just said yesterday that if it happens, he'll tear it to pieces in reciprocity. So What happens if things really get worse with Iran, if Trump goes ahead and kills the Iran deal and they feel they've got nothing to lose but to flex their muscles? They're there, they're right next door. Couldn't they cause us a lot of grief?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that we shouldn't delude ourselves that we have the authority or the standing to be able to help a body win re-election in the first place. I think our influence there is very limited. They're going to have an election. They're going to decide on their own. And yet, at the same time, the fact that our diplomatic standing is so much reduced, or has been so much reduced over the last several months, certainly plays into the problems that will result if Abadi loses and Maliki comes back to power, or if some other more pro-Iranian leader comes to power in Baghdad. That is obviously very detrimental to our interests and is likely to lead to further conflict inside Iraq between Sunni populations, between the Shia majority in the south, and between the Kurds in the north. And so our ability to contain or help defuse a future conflict is vastly reduced as a result. And that does not serve our interests, given how much blood and treasure we've expended in that country over the course of the last years.
But it looks as though that our best ally, if you will, in that neighborhood, the Kurds, are going to get squeezed from all sides. Iran, already, they've taken Kirkuk, and Baghdad, which in collusion with Iran. And then you've got Turkey, where Erdogan is quite adamant about curtailing any independence. He's already sent, they already did military maneuvers with the Iraqi army on the border with Iraqi Kurdistan. And we know that Erdogan is hysterical about U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis Gulen being here in the United States, and there's a trial going on in New York that might well lead to the fingerprints of his family, Erdogan's family, involved in corrupt dealings with Iran to circumvent sanctions. So that could also strain things even further. So is there anything that the U.S. can do? And I imagine, by extension, Israel, too, because Israel's made an investment in relations with Kurdistan. If Kurdistan goes under or is basically landlocked, isolated, isn't that a big setback?
Yeah, well, you know, the region is a mess, and trends are going in the wrong direction, a lot of them you've just cited. I think, you know, particularly important is the Iraqi Kurdistan region's loss of Kirkuk, which now makes them non-viable as a quasi-independent entity within Iraq, and that will change the geopolitics of the region. And before, you know, 6 months ago, a year ago, you had a very good relationship between Erdogan, actually, and Barzani, not between Turkey and the Syrian Kurds, who were at each other's throat, but between Turkey and Iraqi Kurdistan, you actually had a pretty good relationship. Now that relationship is soured, and so that makes things much more complex. And then, of course, you've got the Syrian Kurds, who are being squeezed, but frankly, who are a little overextended. A lot of them have gone as far south as Deir ez-Zor, and as you say, they're about to take or are in the process of taking Raqqa right now. But Raqqa is a historically Sunni city. It is not a historically Kurdish city. And so it doesn't make sense to have the Kurds stay there as a holding force once they clear it of foreign ISIS fighters. And what that signals to me is that over the next couple years, unfortunately, we've set the conditions for the possible creation of ISIS 2.0, because a lot of the local population that were sympathetic to or joined up with ISIS in places like Raqqa, they will remain on the ground and they will be hostile to any occupying force, whether it's Kurdish or Russian or Assad regime, and they will stay there and they will eventually come back. And so, you know, without some sort of clearer governance structure in the region, where entities, where ethnic groups control regions that they have historically controlled and govern them based on their own strictures, we're in for a very, very tumultuous time, both in Syria, in Iraq, in southern Turkey, and bodes very poorly for the region and for our interests there.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Michael Carpenter, What do you think's going on with Israel in terms of its strategic thinking? Clearly, the Israelis and the Saudis, they have some sort of de facto alliance, it would seem, at least in terms of opposition to Iran. I don't know whether they want the U.S. to fight their wars for them, but they're certainly quite hawkish about Iran. But at the same time, they must be worried about growing Iranian influence in Syria, given the role of the Quds and of Hezbollah, and now they're battle-hardened and trained with an enormous amount of equipment. And as you mentioned, they look like they'll get their land bridge, the so-called Shia Crescent, all the way from Iran into the Mediterranean. And at that point, Israel has to feel pretty threatened, don't they?
Well, they do feel threatened, and Prime Minister Netanyahu opposed the so-called de-escalation concept that Turkey and the Kurds had agreed in southern Syria. I think that he's probably very worried right now, and yet he's opposed vociferously to the Iran deal, which doesn't really make any sense. It's an ideological position which I think is actually contrary to Israel's national security interests, but that's the position that he's articulated. And his number one foreign policy priority when coming to Washington has always been to advocate for scrapping the nuclear deal and for getting a new deal, which obviously is not going to happen. And so Israel is very vulnerable, but some of the vulnerabilities are frankly of its own making, at least as far as this current leadership is concerned in Israel.
Well, Dr. Michael Carpenter, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Michael Carpenter, who's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense with responsibility for Russia, Ukraine, Eurasia, the Balkans, and conventional arms control. He previously served in the White House as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and as Director of Russia at the National Security Council. Prior to that, he was a career Foreign Service officer with the State Department and is now Director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the $600,000 expense incurred by his public university today because Richard Spencer decided to speak there. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Clay Calvert, who's the Brechner Eminent Scholar in Mass Communications and director of the Marion B. Brechner First Amendment Project at the University of Florida in Gainesville. He's authored and co-authored more than 130 law journal articles on topics related to freedom of expression. Welcome to Background Briefing, Clay Calvert.
Thank you for having me.
And an American Nazi, Richard Spencer, was able to exercise his freedom of speech at the university, your university there in Gainesville, Florida, Clay. But it does come at a cost, and we've already seen this in Berkeley, where the campuses have to put out enormous resources and expenses with police, etc., just to allow a provocateur to come on campus who may not even have much of a following on campus. But nevertheless, this seems to be the MO of people like Spencer and Yiannopoulos of Breitbart.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, this has cost the University of Florida more than $500 million. The latest estimate is up to $600,000 to protect his right to speech under the First Amendment. And it's kind of the irony proving that free speech really isn't free, and that money is coming directly from the University of Florida and other government agencies. It's designed to prevent what we would call a heckler's veto. And the heckler's veto principle is the idea that the hostile audience reaction silences the speaker. And so in order to prevent violence on campus, and if, what one thing that the University of Florida certainly learned from the incidents in Charlottesville and Berkeley was to have an overwhelming police presence. And that is what happened today. The event itself so far went off peaceably. A lot of heckling of him went on, drowning out his message, but no violence. The only thing I've heard is the Gainesville Police Department within the past 10 minutes reported that one shot was fired out of a car, though, and they're searching for that. But otherwise, it went off relatively well without violence. So that's a victory.
So who invited him onto campus?
Well, actually, nobody invited him, and that's one thing the University of Florida has tried to make very clear. At the University of Florida, we have a number of different facilities where speakers can talk, and they don't need a group to sponsor them. In this case, it was the Phillips Center for the Performing Arts, which has, you know, musical acts, plays, political speakers, comedians, you name it, TEDx. Events like that. And you do not need a student group or other university organization to invite you to speak on campus. The situation then becomes this from a First Amendment perspective. Once you create a public forum like that, a limited public forum, then the government, in this case the University of Florida, cannot discriminate based upon the viewpoint of the message. So it can't say, we're only going to allow speakers with a pro-choice perspective but not a pro-life perspective. That would be viewpoint-based discrimination. So in this case, it would be equivalent to, well, we can't only allow pro-diversity, pro-inclusion speech. We also have to allow the Richard Spencers of that world who have the complete opposite perspective.
And Spencer's organization, the National Policy Institute, paid $10,000, right, to rent the facility?
Yeah, that's all that it paid. And of that, about $3,500 was for security inside the venue. So, yeah, that sum, $10,000, is dwarfed by the $600,000 this will probably end up costing the university. I mean, there were dozens and dozens and dozens, literally more than 100 police cars and law enforcement cars on campus and the surrounding areas today to prevent violence. So that overwhelming law enforcement presence, I think, was very important here. Some people might view it as overkill because it, you know, fanned the flames and maybe attracted attention to Richard Spencer. But I think the last thing the University of Florida wanted was the type of violence that you had at Berkeley or in Charlottesville.
Well, in Charlottesville in particular, there was criticism that the police were too passive.
Exactly.
So it seems like they did the right thing by basically having such a presence that there was no way that there could be, I don't know whether you would have even had a clash, because who was there today on your campus at the University of Florida in Gainesville to support Richard Spencer?
Very, very few individuals. The Phillips Center, the venue where he spoke, seats just over 1,700 people. And I've watched videos of it now, and it's been taped, and approximately 500 to 700 people were there, so they didn't even fill it. And of those individuals who were hurt, his supporters, probably fewer than 100 were actually attended the event itself. So, and the protesters who got tickets inside essentially drowned him out, chanting "Go home, Spencer," "No Nazis," and things like that. And he had a microphone. He was able to talk. He had about four or five different supporters on stage who would take the microphone every once in a while. And he did field questions from audience members. But really, relatively speaking, thousands and thousands of protesters, you know, at this university drowned him out.
So what can be done going forward? And I take it, I mean, in terms of fringe right-wing people who are basically looking for publicity, which is what I think a fair way to describe Spencer, and provoking incidents in order to get publicity. And the fact that they cost Berkeley so much money, we won't even talk about what the cost in Charlottesville, where a woman was run down and killed by a car driven by one of Spencer's supporters. But you just mentioned the $600,000-plus expense incurred today by your university. Now, the fact that Florida's governor declared a state of emergency, did that mean that the state can help you out financially?
Yes, I think that's one of the things that did. The other part was it allowed coordination and kind of cut down the bureaucracy between the various law enforcement agencies. I think that was really the more important part with that, because then it allowed the National Guard as well was called up by Governor Scott, but also better coordination then between all of the law enforcement agencies. We had the University Police Department, the Gainesville Police Department, the Alachua County Sheriff, or in Alachua County here. You had the state troopers. And so there was really necessary to have somebody say, okay, this is an emergency situation, we can coordinate it and all work together. And I think that's what happened. In terms of the overall lessons to be learned, because indeed, as you point out, this is a very costly endeavor, especially at public universities, which are rather cash-strapped today. If there were multiple protests at the University of Florida like this, or multiple speakers of Richard Spencer's ilk, you could run this cost up to several $1 million fairly quickly. Imagine we got three more like him. And that's an exorbitant amount to pay. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has made it pretty clear that it is the government's burden to protect a speaker from a hostile audience. In this case, the hostility was just speech, but what we really mean is a hostile, violent reaction. And due to the security, we didn't have that. I'm on the University Faculty Senate, and the president today of our university, Ken Fox, spoke, and I asked him a question on what would it be one piece of advice you would give to other public university presidents out there. And he would say, and what he said was, to try to have everybody go about their business as usual. Don't cancel classes. And that's the thing I actually taught today. I had very few students attend, and certainly Jewish students and students of color, I totally understand why they didn't come to class. You know, I'm posting the notes online. I had my TA take notes. I don't usually do that, post them, but tonight I totally understand. But that's an important thing that the president mentioned of our university, that people need to go about their business and continue it, and don't give him the satisfaction of basically saying, oh, we're so afraid, we can't go on. And the overwhelming presence here, I think, allowed that, although clearly a number of people were scared.
Well, it's pretty clear that Breitbart, Yiannopoulos, and Stephen Bannon, and David Horowitz, and these right-wing provocateurs choose Berkeley for the obvious reason that it's sort of a liberal bastion. And of course, they're costing the University of California, Berkeley, an awful lot of money. And the UC system, like all universities, public universities, is strapped, as you mentioned. But on your campus, Norman Goder, professor of the Holocaust Studies at the Center for Jewish Studies, and Paul Ortiz, the director of the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program, also at the University of Florida, Gainesville, they have made the point that the reason why Spencer, the American Nazi, chose your campus was simply because there are a number of Jewish and Latino students. So that seems to be proof, not that we really need it, that all of this, what this is all about, is provoking trouble, publicity, by insulting minority groups and being in their face. And that's the MO. And I don't know how can we police this going forward in terms of the First Amendment?
Sure. I don't think, unfortunately, that there is an easy answer to that question. We do have the First Amendment, and it's generally a very good thing. One of the kind of the collateral damage of the First Amendment is that we have to tolerate the intolerant speech of others. And certainly he is, as you said, a provocateur. He's a button pusher. We do, as you suggest, have a large Jewish population, the Hillel, here on campus. The Jewish student organization is one of the largest in the country, a large Latin population, Latino population here as well, obviously with South Florida. So, I think chooses these universities strategically. He's already chosen Michigan State and filed a lawsuit against Michigan State. Pennsylvania State University, the largest public university in Pennsylvania, has denied him access, so he might sue Penn State. Basically, it's a speaking tour. And again, I don't think they're very easy answers, but a part of it is either, not giving him the satisfaction of disrupting the normal activities, but that comes at a huge cost of a law enforcement presence. But, I just don't think there's an easy answer, unfortunately, in this case. I really wish there were. but there's just not.
Well, I think a part of their tactics, apart from getting attention, they also, in many ways, want to be portrayed as martyrs. So they're kind of hoping that universities will prevent them from speaking, and therefore they can cry censorship.
Absolutely right. Oh, no, no. They want to say, look, you're violating our constitutional rights. You're infringing us, the censorship, that they become essentially the oppressed group because we're violating their First Amendment rights. That's how they would try to frame themselves. And indeed, when you listen to Spencer's talk, which I watched it online from today, you know, he's complaining that the audience's reaction constitutes that heckler's veto that the First Amendment protects against. But I think really what the First Amendment protects against is the physical violence where the speaker is actually forced off stage. But now, very savvy, framing themselves, we're the victim here, you're censoring us, that's the MO, and the MO is to hit these major universities, and, you know, there's nothing would prevent him from renting a private space at the, let's say, the Holiday Inn, you know, or the Hyatt or the Hilton, just rent a ballroom and talk, but there's no First Amendment issue there, so strategically, hey, let's go to some ground, which is a public university, and plead the First Amendment, and they can't deny us that. So, you know, again, it is very strategic. Rather than going to a private place where he could rent a ballroom, he's picking public universities to get the First Amendment into play.
And picking public university with a large population of Jewish students, in this case Latino students, both of whom, and I imagine African-American students as well, all of whom are insulted by the stance that this speaker's taking. So it's so flagrantly provocative. But just in closing, let's talk a little bit about how it's often said in terms of the First Amendment that the limits to the First Amendment are you can't cry fire in a crowded theater. Well, isn't what happened today at the University of Florida in Gainesville crying fire in a crowded theater?
So what you're talking about, and that's the quote, you can't falsely shout fire in a crowded theater, that taps into the test for incitement to violence. And so sure enough, the Supreme Court has carved out an exception from First Amendment protection of speech. And that exception is known as the incitement to violence test. It's the modern standard of what people have heard as the clear and present danger test. Most people are familiar with that, clear and present danger. Well, the current version of that requires an intent on the part of the speaker to produce imminent, meaning timely, lawless action, and that action has to be likely to occur. And that's very different from the abstract advocacy of hate, which is protected by the First Amendment. But if Spencer today had his followers there and he pointed to them, I want you all right now to go and attack those black students, the Latino students, the Jewish students, and he also gave them some means to do that, that would cross the line to the imminent incitement to lawless action. But if he just spews his bile about racism and his racist beliefs, that's protected by the First Amendment, and I think that's one thing we need to make clear, is that hate speech is not an unprotected category of speech. Fighting words are words one-on-one, face-to-face, where a person's going to swing back. Incitement to violence is not protected. But the abstract advocacy of hate and disagreeable, offensive ideas, that's protected.
Well, just in closing, though, do you think our president, Donald Trump, has actually given people like Spencer a lot more oxygen than that they deserve by saying that there are good people on both sides, referring to the American Nazis chanting with their tiki torches, blood and soil, etc., Jews will not replace us, with the protesters in Charlottesville. It obviously upset a lot of people, but it's still out there, and believe it or not, Trump doubled down on it again and basically keeps insisting that there are good people on both sides when most people don't see anything good about Spencer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it creates a climate in which this speech is legitimated, especially when he said that, and he did. He said, very fine people, both sides. You know, that was what he said. Then they backed him down, and he walked it back, and then he said it again, as you said. And I think this kind of creates this climate for intolerant, hateful speech to breed and fester. That kind of atmosphere that we have, especially when you're the President of the United States, who refuses to condemn in stark terms racism and hate is just not a good thing. And we live in a politically polarized climate today. It's an oven that's kind of overheated, and it's punctuated by blasts of hot air from Trump.
Well, Clay Calvert, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Clay Calvert, who's the Brechner Eminent Scholar in Mass Communication, director of the Marion B. Brechner First Amendment Project at the University of Florida in Gainesville. He's authored and co-authored more than 130 law journal articles on topics related to freedom of expression. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the latest Kremlin-approved straw man to run against Vladimir Putin in Russia's next presidential election.
I learned a good way. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Gorham, who's a professor of Russian studies at the University of Florida and assistant editor of the Russian Review and Russian Language Journal. He's the author of After Newspeak, Language, Culture, and Politics in Russia from Gorbachev to Putin, and Speaking in Soviet Tongues, Language, Culture, and the Politics of Voice in Revolutionary Russia. He also recently co-edited Digital Russia, The Language, Culture, and Politics of New Media Communications, and his newest project is titled Russia's Digital Revolution, Language, New Media, and the Unmaking of Civil Society. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Gorham.
Glad to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us, Michael. And of course, on an unrelated matter to the subject I called you about, your university today was visited by an American Nazi. It cost your university about $600,000, I understand, to deal with this uninvited, not that he was an uninvited guest, but an unwelcome guest. What was your thoughts on the matter?
Yes, it was quite a quiet day on campus, as it turned out, given all the build-up and preparations. A lot of students opted to simply stay off campus altogether and sit quietly at home. But the event did take place. I caught a little bit of the performance, if you will, electronically, courtesy of Russian television, actually, curiously enough. They had a live feed on RT. Not much of substance seemed to go on at the venue, and I honestly don't really know what happened after the talk ended around 3:30 p.m. Eastern time.
Well, let's turn to the reason why I called you, Michael, and that is that Russia's Paris Hilton has announced that she's going to run for president in the next election, and it's been certainly the main opposition figure, Navalny, is not very happy about it, and there's just an assumption that since Ksenia Sobchak's father was pretty much Vladimir Putin's mentor, he was the mayor of St. Petersburg, she's allegedly met with Putin only a week or two ago in the Kremlin, and now she's saying that Putin has nothing to do with her running. But it does look as though her job is to split the opposition vote.
That seems to be the case. Of course, with the information flow in Russia the way it is, we never really quite know for sure. But there is a track record of the Kremlin tapping somewhat appealing oppositional type figures to get their names on the ballot and draw greater attention to the election, give it more credibility, and ideally bring out a critical mass of voters. And this happened back in 2012 with Mikhail Prokhorov, the tycoon and businessman, and he did a fairly good job on all three counts, but as a reward, ended up getting the axe by the Putin administration in the form of being forced to sell off his holdings in some of his major media companies. So the it's quite unclear what if it was an agreement between Putin and Sobchak, what the offer consisted of. In her defense, we have to remember that she was a pretty prominent member in the opposition movement back in 2011 and 12. She was a member of the council that got together and tried to mount a campaign in those presidential elections, and Putin was visibly unhappy with that. But to see her as a credible candidate for the presidency, despite her name recognition, would be a pretty bad assumption. Now, if we were to see her father in that position, he certainly was a great statesman, the former mayor of Petersburg, and one of the more vocal spokespeople for the Perestroika movement in the first parliament that Gorbachev put together, and she is not her father's daughter in that regard.
Well, in terms of her connections to Putin, of course, Putin was close to her father, and she's been called or been known in Russia as Putin's goddaughter. And earlier this month, she interviewed Putin for a film about her father. And apparently, at least according to the BBC, subject stayed behind and spoke with Putin after the cameras were turned off. And as I say, that wasn't that long ago. So that has certainly raised some suspicions. And the very fact that the legitimate leader of the opposition, Alexei Navalny, who the Kremlin is stopping from running, in spite of supporters rallying for him in 80 Russian cities, that on its surface looks like a betrayal, doesn't it?
On the part of Sobchak toward Navalny?
Yeah.
Yes, although I did hear her say subsequently that if in some unexpected case he were to be allowed to run for the presidency and get his name on the ballot, then she would remove her candidacy, saying explicitly that it was not her goal to split the opposition, and that would be the wrong thing to do at this time. But frankly, I really don't think that's going to happen. Navalny probably himself doesn't expect that to happen. I think he's playing a much longer game, and frankly, a very shrewd one in terms of getting his name recognition out there, establishing campaign offices and all across the Russian Federation, far, far more of a presence than any of the official political parties, really. So it's difficult to say. Yes, Navalny is not happy about the move, but I'm not quite sure that we could see it as an outright betrayal on her part.
But opposition figures, as we know, in Putin, the journalist, of course, Anna Politkovskaya was murdered 10 years ago on Putin's birthday. A very prominent opposition figure, Boris Nemtsov, was murdered literally, within 100 meters or so of the Kremlin.
That's right.
And Navalny himself has been arrested on trumped-up charges and was recently accosted, and green liquid was thrown in his face, which has blinded him in one eye. So I don't see this kind of Paris Hilton type who has had a sort of reality TV show on Russian TV talking about what latest fashion she was wearing, I suppose in a way almost like Kim Kardashian, that she doesn't seem to have the gravitas. She certainly hasn't sacrificed like other opposition figures have. not that one would expect people to die, but that's the hazard of running against Putin, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose it is. The Prokhorov, I don't think ever was subjected to physical threats the way the Nemtsov, Navalny, and Politkovskaya were. So the folks he perceives or his people perceive to be truly threatening maybe don't even make it to the ballot. And I think the fact that she's even even looks like she will become a presidential candidate means that that they see her as a pretty anodyne option.
But in Prokhorov's case, he's pretty well known, right? He owns a big U.S. basketball team.
Yes, he's the owner of the New York Nets.
Mm-hmm.
And multiple yachts and businesses. He was formerly the owner of a large media holding company. One of the oldest internet based news sources, RBK in Russia, but has since been encouraged to divest of those holdings because RBK was doing a little bit too much investigative reporting into the personal family ties of Vladimir Putin.
Well, isn't that a pattern? The first thing that happened was Berezovsky was put in exile. His media holdings were taken over. Guzinski's media holdings were taken over. And now Vkontakte, the equivalent of Facebook in Russia, was taken over by Putin and
yes.
And his Siloviki, the Kremlin cronies. And then Prokhorov's holdings is just the latest in that pattern. That's what's fascinating about this kind of the new politics of Russia is that it's been referred to as managed democracy, where you have the patina of democracy, which is arguably why Prokhorov was allowed to run and why Sobchak's running, so that you can't have a complete sham, right? When you only have one candidate, at least you have the sort of decoration of democratic elections. But in general, it seems that some of the cynicism from Russia, from the so-called political technologists, as the Russians refer to them, like Surkov, who was a theater director and became a media advisor of Putin's, hasn't that sort of cynicism migrated here to the United States in our politics with fake news and the accusations of fake news on the part of Donald Trump, and where he's managed to get his supporters to believe that everything he says is true, whereas everything else that the mainstream press prints is fake news?
Well, the one major difference is that, of course, the Trump administration doesn't have the stronghold on the mainstream media or even the alternative media that the Kremlin can boast, nor are they capable of creating puppet candidates in various levels of elections. As far as the issue of fake news, I think there is a pretty demonstrated track record of outright false news stories being fabricated by Russian sources, specifically with regard to the annexation of Crimea and the conflict in southeastern Ukraine, and some documentation that similar stories have been broadcast and put together and used against Germany and against the United States. That sort of atmosphere, if you will, is easily propagated with the spread of internet technology, as we're finding out, and the ability to like stories, pass them on without any real consideration about the authenticity. And so I think the recent stories that we're hearing about Facebook and Google and other internet companies actually discovering that they've been then they've been used and abused by Kremlin-run or funded troll factories is definitely a cause for concern. Now, did those efforts end up getting Donald Trump elected? I think that's giving too much credit to the Kremlin trolls, and there are plenty of other reasons that are American-born for this sort of climate that we're facing.
But just in closing, though, can you make a kind of comparison? Obviously, Putin has taken over all of the media, and that's not unusual for autocrats and despots and others around the world, like Erdogan in Turkey, and the Chinese leader, of course, they have the same domination of the media. But the extent to which Trump does have a willing media outlet. He does have Sinclair, he has Fox, he has Breitbart, Rush Limbaugh on talk radio, etc. So is that a fair analogy? It seems un-American in a way to have a kind of Pravda here in the United States, whatever form it takes.
Yes, although there are options and choices that the viewing and listening public have in the United States that the Russian population doesn't have. I mean, in Russia, yes, the internet is still open and relatively free, although that climate is changing quite quickly. And I think if Putin had his way, that it would become a little bit more controlled. But in the United States, one can easily tune in or tune out as one desires. So the effect of the echo chamber, I don't think, is quite as dramatic. If you see what I'm saying, people who it's sort of the phenomenon that people who want to tune in and buy into news stories that are highly dubious will go ahead and do that. But I'm not sure how many opinions are being swayed in the cacophony of real fake news and semi-fake news and inconvenient news that's out there in the ether as we speak.
Well, Michael Gorham, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Glad to be with you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Michael Gorham, a professor of Russian studies at the University of Florida and associate editor of the Russian Review and Russian Language Journal. He's the author of After Newspeak, Language, Culture, and Politics in Russia, From Gorbachev to Putin, Speaking in Soviet Tongues, Language, Culture, and Politics of Voice in Revolutionary Russia. He co-edited Digital Russia, The Language, Culture, and Politics of New Media Communications. And his newest project is Russia's Digital Revolution, Language, New Media, and the Unmaking of Civil Society. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.